Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Future Archives Digital Practices and Cultural Memory Debate, a part of Culturefile at the Beta Digital Festival in Dublin's Liberties. The title doesn't use the word memory palace, but for our panel, the particular relationship between space and memory is crucial. That space offers a powerful way to preserve and access memory, has strong classical roots, using visualizations of familiar spatial environments to enhance the recall of information, of story, but also of emotion. By tradition, the memory palace is imaginary, but contemporary technologies offer to build them into data space, which is of interest both to keepers and users of historical archives, but also, of course, to artists and their audiences. That's all of you there. All of which camps are represented both in the audience and up here on the stage. So with us today and closest to me is Dr. Basil Alwawi, who is an Irish-Iraqi artist working notably with immersive technologies to explore cultural memory. His ongoing work is House of Memory, which allows visitors to encounter images from the crowdsourced Iraq photo archive within a 3D reconstruction of a traditional Iraqi Shanashil house via a VR headset. Conor McIver is a filmmaker from Belfast. He's a video artist, designer for performance, and notably creating the stage designs for explosive experiences for live shows such as Gina Moxley's The Patient Gloria and Connor Mitchell's Abomination. His work in immersive environments includes The Estate, which provides an immersive open-world platform for the stories of young working-class men in Belfast during the pandemic, currently available to see online on YouTube. Next, Dr. Autumn Brown is a transdisciplinary researcher interested in science education and how ideas are brought into public spaces, and one of her methods is via the Art and Science Salon event series and podcast, of which she is co-founder and co-host. And right at the other end is Dr. Kieran Wallace, who's a historian from TCD, who, as keeper of the Virtual Record Treasury of Ireland, is one of the drivers behind Beyond 2022, an ambitious project to recreate in virtual reality what was lost when the records treasury of the Public Records Office of Ireland, which was their home, was destroyed during the Irish Civil War in 1922. Hello, Kieran. Hello, everybody. So I've done a kind of quick outline of your projects, but maybe I thought, who better than the actual instigators of their projects to tell us about them? So Basil, what would they encounter in the Memory House?
So what you will encounter is a number of things. You will find some photographs on the wall, which is a small selection of photographs from the Iraq Photo Archive. And these photos are personal family photos that were shared by Iraqi diaspora from all around the world to the crowdsourced online platform. So there's a small selection of photographs from that collection on the wall. I've created a majlis, kind of a traditional majlis seating area. So it's kind of like a domestic Arabic living room space.
Including with a take your shoes off sign.
Including with
a take. In case anybody culturally wasn't aware of that.
Indeed, yes. So you can take a seat and relax and put on the headset. And when you put on the headset, you will be able to experience the House of Memory for your project, which once you put that headset on, you will be inside a virtual reconstruction of a traditional Iraqi Shanashil house. And within this space, you will see two photographs from the collection. When you navigate through the space, you can interact with one or other of the photographs. And when you do, you are transported into a virtual reconstruction of the moment of that photograph. And the one of the subjects in the photograph, who I interviewed as part of the project, retells a story about their memory of this moment. And the world then builds virtually around you based on their narrative.
Did you use the what happens is that the sort of space of the photograph is sort of extended in a way that's one of the tricks in AI to say what would have been in this Mona Lisa photograph if we could see more. How did you produce that extended image?
Exactly. So this was all this was all done prior to this generative AI development. I was doing it in a manual way, so I was looking at the photographs and doing a type of image analysis to determine what was denoted in the image. So what physical architectural objects are present within the frame, and then using an analysis of the interviews to analyze things like emotion or other kind of denoted content, I constructed the environment based around what was present in the frame visually, but then also what was present in the narratives.
Thank you. Conan, you too are requiring, well, not always requiring people to use a VR headset, because as I said, there is a version of the estate that's linear.
So I have two kind of immersive projects on the go, but the one I'm presenting at BETA here is the estate it's an interactive game installation. So you'd first be confronted by a CCTV monitor, which would be monitoring the person playing the game. Once you go into the space, there's a bus shelter, where you play the game through an Xbox controller. And so there's a big virtual projected visual sound world, which is really a stage for storytelling. So like a promenade performance, you would traverse around the space, encounter different dance, theater, storytelling. And there's a loose kind of narrative journey to it. And if you get lost, there's a bus map that kind of help ground you to around the experience. I mean, interestingly, the journey of this piece was, it all came out of COVID in terms of a commission by the Lyric Belfast and Future Screens for theatre makers to make storytelling in a digital space. And, you know, really, you know, a lot of people have been doing, you know, different kind of interventions online and so on. But I really thought, well, if I'm trying to do something theatrical, what can I do in a digital space that can't be done on an actual stage? And I had this image in my head of a ballet dancer in front of a row of police vans that had a car diffing around it. And I thought, well, that's not something easily accomplished on stage and probably better suited to a digital environment. So I was working with young people in care in Belfast at the time and kind of mining their stories. And then we created these, what I call composite narratives, taking fragments of different people's stories and then having them re-perform through the environment. So the first iteration of this was just on a desktop computer, which you can access on my website and download for yourselves. But the feedback I got was, you know, the scale of the environment, it really demanded like a larger projection or larger stage. So this is where the installation concept came from. I actually did do a cinematic version of it that we showed in the IFI, but having done now the installation version, I think like this is the way the work is intended to be shown.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that section with the ballet dancer and the spinning car, and I was thinking, well, on my screen, there's something like I never thought it would be so soothing to watch a car making donuts around a ballet dancer, but the experience of it is actually very pleasurable. I wonder how intense it becomes when it gets large. I couldn't imagine on a cinema screen. Kieran, I guess yours isn't an art project, but it uses all very, very similar tools to what Basil and Conan described.
That really struck me when I was looking at their work earlier on, and I had the pleasure of seeing Conan's exhibition just before I came here. The project I'm working on is to digitally recreate the Public Record Office of Ireland, the state archives that were destroyed in 1922 in the opening battle of the Civil War. So just like, half a kilometre from here, if we were here on the 30th of June 1922, we'd be deafened by the sound of gunfire demolishing the forecourts and the whole thing going up in smoke. 7 centuries of Irish historical records all destroyed, leaving a huge chasm in Irish history. And then over the course of the 100 years since then, various archivists and scholars have tried to sort of fill the gap. But in 2016, our project began as a combination of historians and computer scientists in Trinity College with lots of archivists and librarians to find any copies. It was a simple project to begin with, any copies that were made before 1922 that are still out in libraries around the world, and could we copy some number of those and bring them back together? But the more we looked, the more we found. And then the computer scientists got very excited by this because there was lots of challenges in how they were digitally stored in different repositories around the world. Could they be brought together on kind of a neutral digital platform that allowed the user just to meet them as if they were in the record treasury across the road, across the river, and encounter the records as if it was 1922 or earlier. So our work it's interesting, sort of, we've had an artist work with us on the works, and Mairead McLean has done a wonderful piece called Acts of Memory, a videography piece. But that idea of, as we look into, we're historians mainly on my side of the project, looking at the records, and we're all concerned about the history on the page, but then what the digital allows you to do, what it allows you to do in ways that couldn't have been done if the record treasury had never burnt down. We can get into the records in ways, find voices that were never there. I'm conscious of people talking about voices that might not be recorded or people that mightn't be included in the official record. And there's lots of that in the state records, lots of absent voices and oppressed voices and suppressed voices. But can we do something through digital means? We have millions, 100 million, more than 100 million words of digitized text that's fully searchable on virtualtreasury.ie. So virtualtreasury.ie is where you can just go on. In a way, you nearly get too much information. Part of the challenge is to make the information curated that people can understand what they're getting. But the more I look at it as a historian with no real knowledge of the digital side other than sitting in and meetings with computer scientists, but the artistry that's there and the way that our computer science colleagues look at it and say, can you mine this for different things? Can you link things that could never have been linked in the physical archive? So I think that's why I think that conferences like BTAR are so interesting to present that challenge.
Autumn, I guess you're here as a researcher, primarily as an encounterer of archives. So I wonder what this kind of movement towards I hesitate to use the word gamification, but at least the increasing use of visualization technologies in archives means or how it alters your traditional experience of an archive.
Well, I'm interested in knowledge building in all of its forms, the ways in which we build knowledge, the way we transfer knowledge, the way we share knowledge. And so I'm really fascinated actually by this project and to have not only this incredible endeavor of filling in the gaps of history that were taken, that were burned to the ground in such a beautiful, immersive space, making it something where it's not just a traditional kind of like digging for information. You're actually building an experience for people to really encounter in a much more sensorily, expressive way. It's something that's a lot more inviting. I think at the moment it's really, really difficult to ask people to spend a lot of times digging through dusty tomes, spending time going through cardboard boxes full of like flashcards with, typed messages on them, or reading loads and loads and loads of papers or books. It's a lot to ask of our attention. You read all the time right now about attention deficit. So what are the ways in which we can further engage people in deeply meaningful way? Not ways that are gimmicky, not ways that are shallow, but understand that kind of our relationship with knowledge building is evolving as these tools and our relationships with these tools evolve. So making the best of the tools kind of at our disposal to invite people into knowledge that was stolen, that was destroyed, or knowledge that hasn't even been shared yet. So I think everybody on the panel who's, doing this kind of work, you're inviting people into spaces that are humanizing things that are difficult, filled with conflict, violence, crimes, war crimes, horrible things, inviting people into spaces that otherwise they might never encounter through creative means. And as a researcher who's interested in, like I said, relationships with knowledge, usually science, if I'm being honest, it was so exciting. I love it. I really, really, it's amazing.
I mentioned memory palaces at the beginning, and there is a story that's probably, it's apocryphal, but worth retracing. Just this association between catastrophe and memory is kind of interesting, in that the original story is supposed to be a Greek bard who has to perform at an event and leaves the room in order to, go outside for a smoke or something, during which time the room collapses and everybody is lost under the fallen architecture, it's amazing that this theme kind of repeats. And the only way he can, or he is able to access it by remembering the building and then placing the people within the building. And I'm really interested in this sense of catastrophe and how recreating space can somehow work against the catastrophe. Basil. Would you like a question mark there somewhere?
It's about trying to, particularly with this work, it was about trying to promote and present within the digital materiality an aspect of traditional Iraqi cultural heritage which is not defined by conflict and not defined by destruction. Because within the whole kind of pantheon of video games stretching right back to the 1980s, even up until last week and the latest release of the new Call of Duty game, representations of Iraq within a digital materiality and within specifically within video games is 99% as a backdrop or a landscape to first-person shooter games or flight simulators and so on. And so actually using that kind of materiality to construct a type of digital heritage visualization was a way to try and counteract that representation. But you know, in turn, the house is actually constructed based off of a conservation project which took place in 1981 in Adhamiyah in Baghdad, where they went around and they documented in great detail these type of houses which were falling into disrepair because of the nature of the construction materials and so on. Now, they never were able to do that conservation project because of subsequent conflicts and subsequent wars. So the book remains a document of a moment in time. And many of those houses are still there, but there are very, very few of them. So yes, it was also trying to deal with this loss of kind of architectural heritage. But by using the materiality, it was really trying to also counteract this kind of representation within video games.
Which in a way, I mean, it's that sort of negative formation. In fact, the games do have an influence on you, but in a kind of backward formation.
Yeah, I mean, you can encounter these spaces within video games, but generally you will encounter them with a machine gun. And the object will be to destroy something within it, or, you know, so this, it was really trying to create a space where you're not having that kind of experience. And actually, the space is designed around sort of authentic archival materials, which are photographs and architectural plans of those buildings. And then the environments of the photographs are designed based on the authentic narratives of Iraqis.
Conan, the game element is quite big for you as well. I mean, I feel like you're kind of crossing over theatre and game worlds, which is maybe part of your work in general. But the idea that you are in a space for pleasure kind of comes with the tools or the form you're using.
Well, I think the main driving force was that I was very keen to be telling stories of working class young men and in a language that was native to them. You know, this whole experience came out of the fact that I was working with these young kids during lockdown, and most of them were just playing video games. It was how they were getting through, how they were like multiplayer online connecting with their friends.
Yes, at one point in your work, one of the characters says, well, we'll go away and play GTA for a few hours. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, all of this is kind of, it's not verbatim per se, like, but a lot of, like, all this comes out of some conversation someone said or something. So, interestingly, I think, like, to pick up, you know, what Basil was talking about there, so it was very keen that their representation, you know, that was in a language that was native to them, but it was also kind of capturing their stories during this period of time. But, you know, I didn't actually appreciate how much of a time capsule it would be until now. But even, like, looking at the game, so much of it was a product of its time. There was a lot of unrest in Belfast. The primary group I was working with was based in Sandy Row, and that was the time when Brexit negotiations and things were not going so well, and they were burning buses on Sandy Row, and they were getting text messages from people in the community for them to come out onto the street. And so this is all, like, a thread that kind of goes through the game. And also this kind of resurgence of getting people signed up and getting involved in paramilitary activity and all this kind of backdrop. So it kind of appears kind of fun and flashy, but like kind of there's a darkness to the storytelling. But I've seen like the value in terms of the experience. Having shown this now to young men in Belfast and Dublin, the thing that struck me most was that they had never seen their landscape represented in a video game environment, much like Basil was talking about. And, you know, I mean, none of them could cite any example of Ireland in a video game that they had played. So they were very, they talked about the closest was London and some kind of like, you know, Grand Theft Auto bolt on. But so like that is very meaningful for them to see themselves represented. And, you know, the thing about the environment is that, you know, this is kind of a twisted, like there's, you know, there's very identifiable elements of Belfast in there, but it's all been kind of twisted around, you know, how we would maybe reimagine their environment, their local estate as an imagined space. But like all the peace walls and all the graffiti, and actually graffiti was quite a big outlet at the time I was very interested in, was there's some great graffiti there that was around Belfast that we brought into the game.
It's real graffiti in the game then.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I mean, you do make quite a strong element of the graffiti, because quite often you write it in glowing neon and it has this kind of slightly holy, sanctified feel to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that seemed to be an outlet for a lot of people, you know, in terms of, you know, marking what was going on. And obviously, you know, graffiti and street murals and all that stuff is like a, you know, huge language in Northern Ireland. So it felt very important to replicate that. So everything in the game whether it be like the textures and all the assets are generated from the real world.
Autumn, I know you've been looking at issue. I'm very interested in the pleasure component of what's happening here, because it's sort of unavoidable that even if you're, as Basil is, you're working counter to games, you're working in a language where that's calibrated in pleasure, as Kern has been suggesting. Is it paying off in pleasure? I mean, how useful is that for academic work, for instance, or for research?
I think enormously. And we've had a really interesting kind of history of the different things that we want to measure when we're looking at experiences, maybe for me, a science center, a science museum, or a gallery, or a space where you're encountering works of art. I think many years ago, so this would have been like in the 1800s, people did try to come up with a unit of pleasure. So like an inch or a centimeter, a foot, a mile, a gram, measure of weight. But they tried to come up with a unit of pleasure. And they called this unit of pleasure a hedon. And I found this hysterical. I love this. I love that some academic was like, how can we scientify pleasure? I mean, what an extraordinary, silly, silly, lovely, romantic thing to do. You want to dig deep into this extraordinary, ephemeral experience that we have such a difficult time communicating or talking about, and your approach is to find a unit of measurement, develop a unit of measurement. And it's, as a scientist, you know, myself, that appeals to me. I really like the idea.
What were they doing to get the measure?
How far did we get? So they used questions to kind of get to it in the same way that we would use surveys, questionnaires, focus groups today to understand somebody's experience, perhaps with a work of art or a game. A lot of times, you know, they use focus groups to evaluate television shows, films, games. They would have done something quite similar. Obviously, the hedon did not catch on because it's silly.
You've got to agree, strongly disagree instead, which isn't any better,
this,
really.
This was 10 hedons worth of pleasure. This was a million hedons worth of pleasure. I think that's, I love it. I actually think that kind of, you know, science is a work of love. Archiving is a work of love. Creating art is a work of love. These are works of obsession, of passion. It's critical, and of course, you know, that we acknowledge that these experiences, these obsessions, these things that grab us and hold us, that obsess us, it is pleasurable doing a deep dive. I'm a researcher not because there's nothing else in the world I could do, but because I just love immersing myself in something. I love the deep dive. I love it when time passes and you don't know where you are. You don't know what time it is. This is your focus. This is everything. And we get it in that flow state when we're making a piece of art, when we're experiencing a piece of art, you're reading something, you're listening to music, you're doing a deep dive into the archives. And again, I do think the technology and our relationships with technology has changed what that deep dive feels like. Obviously, technology has really, really updated our experience of pleasure, how we experience, how we give pleasure, how we receive pleasure. You know, technology really does mediate that experience for us now, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I wonder if we'll get a new hedon. Who knows?
Well, except that it is an arms race, you know, that as pleasure wears off in one activity, you need to kind of... Maybe art isn't working anymore. Can we add VR into it to see if we can repeat or recapture experiences that people maybe had more regularly?
Yeah, so this has become a real interesting kind of conversation, debate, concern, obsession in the literature. You know, how overstimulating some of our technologies will be, how this harms our attention span, how this harms our need for pleasure, becoming, you know, needing things that are more and more and more extreme, the ways in which our technologies become addictive. And there's arguments to say, like, no, we need to have this return to books. You know, a lot of assignments now in classrooms and in university settings, you can't get students to finish a book. And it used to be that you would have, you know, readings and you would need to assign 10 books and everybody would finish the books and you'd have discussions. You can't do that anymore. You assign a chapter or a half chapter and you take it in bite sizes because students will not read the entire book. Some people think this is terrible. I don't know that it is. It's just going to be, we have to recalibrate. We're changing because our technologies, our tools have changed us. So now we have to update our understanding of how we dispense knowledge, how we make knowledge. And if we are kind of developing these unhealthy relationships with technology, these unhealthy relationships with how we engage with the things that stimulate us, we need to look at that. But I don't think it's necessarily something that's too damning. And again, everyone on the stage, you're using new tools now to do the work that you're doing. And a lot of it is of a historical nature, or in some cases, a very personal nature. And you're using these tools to highlight very human stories that may otherwise not be experienced or felt in the same degree and to the same depth that they are. And those tools are helping you tell these stories and share these experiences. So I don't think it's always bad. I think it's a double-edged sword.
Not always bad, definitely not always bad. But I wonder, Ciarán, in what way do the tools that you're using begin to kind of cast a shadow over traditional archives and their access and emotional availability?
That's an interesting question because
certainly
we find that, something that we kind of grapple with. We deal with lots of archives, thankfully, all around the world who very generously share their digital images with us. We're a free public thing and they like giving stuff free to the public. But that idea of if I take from some small archive, if we sort of share 500 images of a document that's very important, does that mean that people are not going to go and physically visit their archive that they've carefully curated and staffed and keep the doors open on a Monday, Wednesday and Friday and they'll lose footfall? In fact, we find the reverse is true, not for us, but generally that the digital availability draws attention to the physical thing. So the two are not actually in conflict, that more people will go to see the physical thing because they know it exists and they find it because of that sort of maybe serendipity of a digital search. I think the different types of serendipity in a library where the book beside the book you want is a different book and you suddenly pick it up and have a new thought. But there is a serendipity in a search as well if the search algorithm is right. I found your sort of passion, that was quite moving, that notion of using the tools for connecting people in different ways. Certainly we find having to making our records seem relevant to the users. We could have collections which are very boring topics like the medieval exchequer. The medieval exchequer sounds like your eyes would glaze over. But we find actually there's amazing stuff in that tells you really interesting things about people like us 800-900 years ago, or 600 years ago even. But we can, by curating the stories, so we use the technology to tell stories. So it's very much like what people here on the panel are talking about. If you find the story, that's the hook that then will draw people in and allows them to get lost into that sort of flow stream. People will contact us and say, I went down a rabbit hole on your website. And we think, ka-ching, that's it. Like, if they've gone down a rabbit hole, they haven't noticed the passage of time and they ended up in a different part of the rabbit warren than they expected. And if you're trying to research an essay, that can be very frustrating. But if you're trying to get people interested in history, it's a success.
one of the enduring images of your project was this idea that it was a jar of little fragments that had fallen off various books.
And yes. Smaller than cornflakes, a jar which is kept in the National Archives of Ireland as they're conserving and trying to preserve and conserve burnt fragments of records. Any little pieces that fall off, they keep. And that's because everything is being archived. But the notion of what those stories might have told, like it could be a single character, a single letter written on a corner of a piece of paper, but what might the rest of that say? Sometimes they actually can fit them together and make the original story, but more often than not, with those burnt fragments not. So it's up to us to, it's up to the public, and please come and do it, whether it be artists or the artistry and any of us as individuals, come and imagine.
That's an absolutely wonderful place to call a halt. I'd like to very much thank our panel today, who were absolutely terrific. Basil Al-Rawi, Autumn Brown, Ciarán Wallace and Conan McIver.